From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with journalist Randy Schiltz, author of And the Band Played On, a study of the political, economic, and social controversies connected with the AIDS epidemic. Also today, I talk with suspense writer Patricia Highsmith. Her first novel, Strangers on a Train, was made into a movie by Alfred Hitchcock. Highsmith's books are bestsellers in Europe, and they're catching on in America. Rock historian Ed Ward plays a few of the songs that the young Lennon and McCartney gave to other British bands. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Dresden Gate, Michael Schmidt's novel set in Mexico on the eve of the revolution. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Randy Schiltz. He's written a new book titled And the Band Played On, People, Politics, and the AIDS Epidemic. He writes that in the early years of the epidemic, the federal government viewed AIDS as a budget problem, local public health officials saw it as a political problem, gay leaders considered AIDS a public relations problem, and the news media regarded it as a homosexual problem that wouldn't interest anybody else. Consequently, he writes, few confronted AIDS for what it was, a profoundly threatening medical crisis. Schiltz's book documents both the blunders that stalled America in confronting AIDS and the heroic efforts to deal with the epidemic. Schiltz has reported for the San Francisco Chronicle since 1982. Since 83, he was assigned to cover AIDS full-time. He was perhaps the first openly gay staff reporter for a major daily to write about gay issues. His previous book, The Mayor of Castro Street, is a biography of Harvey Milk, the gay San Francisco supervisor who was assassinated. Randy Schiltz's new book, And the Band Played On, is published by St. Martin's Press. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi.
You criticize the media for not getting right on the case of AIDS because they saw it as a homosexual issue that just didn't apply to enough of their readers. You've been covering the story since 82. Why did you first start covering it? When did you realize that this was a more important story than anybody realized?
I did my first story in 1982 largely because everything I was reading was about the guys in the white coats. It was about doctors. It was about scientists, but it wasn't about people who had this. So I did my first story at that time in San Francisco. You could get all of the surviving AIDS patients in one living room, and that's what we did, and I talked too much, and it was more of a human interest story. But right away, since my background was not as a medical writer but as a political reporter, I was very interested in the politics of this, and I started talking to congressmen And it was so clear that this crisis was being treated so differently than other diseases of comparable proportions.
How so?
Well, especially when you go, let's go into early 83 when I'm starting to do my first serious investigations. By then, you could see that AIDS had killed, you know, many, many times more people than Legionnaires' disease and toxic shock combined. And yet, you didn't have even a fraction of the resources devoted to AIDS research. By late 83, I started doing Freedom of Information Act request and from the federal government. And immediately, then you start pulling out what's going on behind the scenes. That's when you find out that government doctors were pleading and begging for money and also warning that by the end of the decade, you know, thousands of people were going to be dying of AIDS if the government didn't get into action. Of course, the Reagan administration turned a deaf ear to the pleas for money. Their priority was in keeping a lid on domestic spending. Consequently, that the epidemic was allowed to fester without the kind of mobilization of the federal research agencies that really could have done an awful lot early on, especially.
So in staying with the behind-the-scenes politics and economics of the story, do you think that you were covering parts of the story that a lot of the other media never got to?
Yes, and still hasn't gotten to. And that was the frustration. I mean, the thing is that we would put these stories on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle, which is one of the largest papers west of Chicago, but you can have a huge story in the West Coast, and because the national media is so biased toward the East Coast, it will just get ignored. And that's what happened with AIDS. You know, I think part of it, too, is just that AIDS dealt with gays. It dealt with and which the national news organizations have long considered to be trivial, not a serious issue, and it dealt with health issues, which again is considered soft news by most of the news media. So all the tough guy investigative reporters are always crawling all over the CIA and the military. And even though this is a disease that's going to kill far more Americans than were killed in Vietnam. Even today, we're not seeing the serious kind of investigative reporting that we should have on something of this critical kind of an issue.
Can I just ask you briefly how you investigate a story like this?
You just do it like you do any story. You just talk to as many people as you can. You develop your sources, and you type up your little. You get a little booklet that you can get from any investigative reporting center that tells you how to do Freedom of Information Act requests, and you can get this stuff. What I've done is stuff that any reporter could have done, but nobody cared enough to do it.
Before we get to some of the political and economic controversies that you cover in your book, I want to ask you about something that you've been getting a lot of attention for, and that is the person known as Patient Zero, the first person with AIDS in America that the medical profession knows of, the person who is attributed with first spreading AIDS.
Yeah, this is a very interesting story that just I wasn't looking for it. But when you talk to enough people, you start hearing bits and pieces. What we have to do is go back and remember what things were like in 1981 with AIDS. Was AIDS a new infectious disease? Was it perhaps caused by drugs or something in the environment? Nobody really knew. But in late 1981, the researchers at the Centers for Disease Control got a tip from a doctor in Los Angeles where he had learned that a number of the early people who got AIDS had all had sex together, or, you know, that there were some links. So what the CDC did was dispatch researchers and talk to as many of their early cases as they could. And they heard one name that came up again and again. It was an unusual name, French-Canadian, so it stuck in their memories. The name was Gaétan Dugas. He was a French-Canadian airline steward for Air Canada, had a voracious sexual appetite, was gorgeous, so he could fulfill it very easily, and could travel all over the place because, being a steward, he got air passes. And by the time that the CDC was done with this research and they talked to Gaétan and got his cooperation, they found that 40 of the first 248 gay men who got AIDS in the United States had either had sex with Gaétan or had had sex with somebody who had had sex with them. Consequently, they're able to link directly 16% of their first AIDS cases. Now, this was very important because it gave a very convincing piece of evidence that AIDS was a sexually transmitted disease. Now, ultimately, we'll never know who brought AIDS into the United States. That remains unknown and unknowable. But a number of researchers say that, you know, he's certainly your likeliest candidate. And his real significance is, I think, it's a curiosity as to who brought it here, and we don't know. But the significance is gave us some good evidence that AIDS was an infectious disease that was sexually transmitted. And that was a very important thing to find out.
Once that evidence was established, was word spread pretty quickly that it was sexually transmitted?
There was a first reluctance at the Centers for Disease Control to be very definitive about this. You've got to look and see what government is like. That these agencies, a lot of these federal agencies, are warring with each other all the time over money. The CDC did not want to be attacked by other federal agencies by looking like it was too hot on the gun on this. So behind the scenes, they were very concerned, and they were starting to write their memos begging for more money, which are being ignored. But still, and there was a lot of hedging. That's the trouble in this epidemic, is scientists very often know what's going on, but they don't speak language of us mortals. You know, everything is qualified and maybe'd so much that there was a lot more mystery than really needed to be. You've got to remember that virtually the same day that they published the Patient Zero study, they also find the first cases of AIDS among hemophiliacs. So this is another piece of convincing evidence that we've got a germ at work here, a virus. And by the end of 1982, when the first transfusion cases are noted, then everybody is convinced, you know, in terms of doctors and researchers, they become fairly well convinced that this is we've got a new infectious disease. So 1983 then becomes a crucial year when you still could have done something. And 1983 is when the Reagan administration, the policy turns in the administration. Before then, nobody was very interested in it. Nobody talked much. In 83, AIDS begins getting publicity because of the transfusion cases. So the Reagan administration has to adapt a course of more proactive lying, that they make grand announcements and say this is our number one health priority. And meanwhile, behind the scenes, they're still denying funds to do even the most basic research at the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health.
What were some of the things happening at that crucial point between the Center for Disease Control and the National Institute of Health?
Well, this is where you begin seeing the influence fighting and the disputes that dominate AIDS research for the next 2 years, from 83 to 85. The Centers for Disease Control was very frustrated that the National Institutes of Health wasn't doing anything about AIDS, so they end up starting their own laboratory to try to find the virus that's causing AIDS. Well, this makes the researchers at the National Cancer Institute, which is an agency of the National Institutes of Health, the National Cancer Institute gets mad and says, wait a minute, that's what we do bench research. There starts to be falling out and rifts between them. Meanwhile, with the appearance of an infectious agent, there's another agency in the federal government, at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is supposed to handle infectious diseases. But they weren't interested in AIDS at all, so the National Cancer Institute was picking it up, and the National Cancer Institute was always terrified that the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases was going to step in and take it over, and we start getting the breakdown of cooperation.
So people were competitive with each other instead of cooperative.
I mean, these are all agencies in the federal government. They all take our tax money, and they're fighting. And meanwhile, the French had already discovered the cause of AIDS. But American researchers, or certain American researchers, did not want the French to get credit for this, were very deprecating of the research, even though the French had discovered it. And then you start the warfare between the Pasteur Institute and the National Cancer Institute. And it gets more mucked up when the Centers for Disease Control, realizing that the French had discovered the cause of AIDS, begins working with the Pasteur, which, and so that creates an even greater rift between the Centers for Disease Control and the National Cancer Institute. At one point, I mean, you had a period of almost a year that the National Cancer Institute had its own AIDS virus and wouldn't give very much of it to the Centers for Disease Control for research because they weren't talking to each other. I mean, you just had an absurd amount of scientific politicking. Now, to some extent, some of this is normal in science, from what I've been told, that this does happen. But what, of course, the level of politicking was utterly smarmy, to be honest. But what also, even though some competition can normally be expected, what was different about this was that we had an epidemic. We had a new infectious disease that's spreading all over the map. And when you have delays in working on this, you don't measure those delays in weeks or months. You measure those delays in lost lives.
Journalist Randy Schultz is my guest, and he's written a new book about the AIDS epidemic called And the Band Played On. Let's talk about the blood banks. Now, as you just mentioned, once hemophiliacs started coming down with AIDS because of blood transfusions, there was certainly evidence that it was being spread through the blood bank. Now, you say that the blood banks could have tested the blood for the AIDS virus much sooner than they actually started doing.
No, they couldn't have. They tested for the AIDS virus as soon as they could. But as early as 1983, when the first cases of AIDS were detected, the AIDS virus wasn't at that time recognized or discovered. But the Centers for Disease Control suggested test for a certain antibody to the hepatitis, the core of the hepatitis virus. Now, those tests would have eliminated 80% of the AIDS carriers who are donating blood out of the blood. It would have prevented 80% of the people who are transmitting AIDS in transfusions. But it also would have eliminated a lot of people who didn't have AIDS. Consequently, it would have eliminated, would have been very expensive for the blood industry to institute. So the blood industry refuses to do it. The Centers for Disease Control is very adamant. They have one huge meeting in January 1983 in Atlanta. You have the person who is in charge of laboratory work on AIDS for the CDC pounding his fist on the table saying to the blood bankers, how many people have to die before you'll do something? What is the threshold of death necessary for action? And as it turned out, the threshold of death was actually rather high. Thousands of people got transfused with blood when it wasn't necessary. And today we're left with a stunning irony in terms of blood banks, that more people have contracted AIDS from transfusions administered after we knew the virus was in the blood supply than before. In other words, a majority of these cases at this point could have been prevented had the blood industry listened to the Centers for Disease Control. But again, it was a political failure that the blood industry was sort of trapped in its own denial. And then also they were concerned about how much money it was going to cost. Now, the blood industry is under the direct regulation of the Food and Drug Administration of the federal government. But when sort of forced to decide between the public health of protecting the blood and the economic viability of the blood industry, the FDA opted to protect the economic viability, essentially the business interest of the blood industry. And it was another one of these the story of AIDS is a story of unnecessary suffering to a large extent. And this is, you know, a very classic example.
When you talk about the blood industry, are you talking about private blood banks? Are you talking about the Red Cross, too?
Very good. There's two different major components we're talking about here. There's the for-profit blood industry that makes blood products. They make the stuff for hemophiliacs and the factor VIII for them. Now, the for-profit blood industry was very responsive because they had their economic interest was they have competition, so they moved very rapidly to test their blood for hepatitis and to screen donors. It was very interesting. They moved rapidly. The people who did not move rapidly were the nonprofits. The Red Cross is at the top of the list, and these nonprofits were essentially they have little monopolies. In each area, it tends to have one blood bank. They're not for profit, but they're huge business enterprises nevertheless. And they are the people who really drag the feet. They didn't have to worry about business pressure, and they didn't, and they were really ensconced in their denial. And so, I mean, the American Red Cross is probably responsible for as many cases of AIDS as any organization in this country, with the exception of perhaps gay bathhouses or something like that.
Just as a point of information here, since we're talking about the spread of AIDS through blood banks, all the blood in blood banks is now tested for AIDS.
It's tested for AIDS.
Virus.
Now, we're talking about a historical period
here,
83 to 85. Today, I wouldn't have any reluctance to get a blood transfusion today. I think the blood supply is very safe.
Okay, thank you. My guest is journalist Randy Schultz. We're discussing the subject of his new book, And the Band Played On, Politics, People, and the AIDS Epidemic. We'll talk more about his investigations into the politics behind the AIDS epidemic after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Journalist Randy Schultz is my guest, and he's a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. I think, in a way, some of the most controversial findings in your book have to do with the gay community's reaction to the AIDS epidemic. And in the introduction to your book, you say to the gay community this was not only a medical but a public relations crisis. There is so much understandable fear of inciting homophobia that it seemed like a very dangerous thing to tell people that somehow there was this virus being transmitted largely in the gay community and sexually transmitted at that.
At the beginning, I think you have to be understanding that nobody knew what was causing this. There was a lag time in getting the information out to people. Then we come to a problem, what starts, I would say, about in 1983, where there's substantial evidence, but then you get a number of business interests again involved, particularly, I think, when we talk about the bathhouses, which was a very major issue in San Francisco, also New York and Los Angeles, that here you had institutions which, I mean, existed to foster lots of anonymous contacts, particularly with anal intercourse, which is your big, you know, the big factor that spreads AIDS in the gay community. Now, there are a number, at first the bathhouses in San Francisco, there were people who said, well, they should at least put up warnings, you know, and warn people, put up brochures. They didn't want to do that. Only the threat of that they might be closed prompted them to do that, and then they did the least amount of information and education as they could. Later, the debate became, you know, should these bathhouses be closed? We've got an extraordinary situation that demands extraordinary means. And that became thoroughly politicized. You had some people in the gay community who wanted to close the bathhouses. You had other people in the gay community who saw this as a civil rights issue, were concerned that if you close the bathhouses, everything else might get closed. And then I think you have less ideological reasons. I think you have gay newspapers that got an awful lot of their advertising revenues from bathhouses. They lined up completely for the bathhouses, for their advertisers. And You had a political, this profound public health issue discussed solely in political terms. And I think it's the problem with AIDS all along, whether you're talking about the Reagan administration or even in the gay community, that you can't address a public health problem on political terms, that at some point you've got to take a medical stance on this.
Now, the impression I get from your book is that you think that the gay community was slow in responding to safe sex practices, and that because so much of homosexuality is based on sexual practices, obviously, and there was so much promiscuity within the gay community, that you thought people were so reluctant to change their sexual practices that they didn't want to face what was happening.
It wasn't so much a reluctance to change sexual practices; it was a denial of the severity of the epidemic. And once gay people got over the denial, then the changes came rather rapidly. I think there's two sides when I talk about the gay community in this book. For all the problems the gay community had in dealing with AIDS, and I document them fully in my book, I think you also have to add that just about anything good that happened in the first 5 years of AIDS also happened because of the gay community. That virtually all the early breakthroughs in research were financed with funds that were lobbied for by gay congressional aides. All the education that was provided in the early years of the epidemic came from volunteer gay organizations with little support from the government. And virtually all the services that are provided for people with AIDS, even today, are done by gay volunteers. So, I mean, I think the problem really in the gay community of politicizing the epidemic was something that happened more a couple of years ago than today. Now, on the other hand, it's the conservatives who I think are politicizing the epidemic, and that's just as bad as gay people politicizing it.
Did any of your coverage or analysis of the gay community's response to the AIDS epidemic get bad reviews within the gay community?
Not yet, because the book is so new. There haven't been a lot of reviews. Well, actually, there has been some reaction. I mean, there are, believe it or not, I guess there are still some people in the gay community who will defend bathhouses. There are cities, such as here in Philadelphia, that still have bathhouses. And so there's still, in San Francisco, it's no longer controversial to be for closing the bathhouses. Because in San Francisco, everybody knows lots of people who've died, and everybody realizes that this is such an important situation that some things simply have to change. And sometimes when I come to these other cities where they still view bathhouses as a political issue instead of a medical issue, I just want to shake some of these people and say, my God, don't make the same mistake we did. You know, don't wait until half of your friends are dying before you move on this.
My guest is journalist Randy Schultz. I want to ask you something about the language that has been used in discussing AIDS. I think the term that we've all been using is the exchange of body fluids.
Yeah.
And as you point out in your book, that's a term that was supposed to stand in for blood and sperm. And no one, I certainly have felt unsure of whether body fluids also means saliva.
See, that's the trouble.
Whether it also means urine as far as public bathrooms mm-hmm. are concerned. And so it's been really a very confusing term.
I call it AIDS speak in my book, which is the creation of a new language to deal with matters which would better be dealt with the straightforward Anglo-Saxon words. Bodily fluids was a great AIDS speak. You know, it let you say exchange of bodily fluids. It let you get away with not talking about anal intercourse and semen in a person's rectum and stuff like that. And so what the effect of not using the simple, straightforward language there was to scare people to death. Bodily fluids, does that mean I can get it from being coughed on in a bus? Does that mean that if a gay waiter coughs on my salad, then I'm going to get AIDS? And there's, you know, that's the problem when you're not honest, that you create a lot of the confusion. Another problem was that doctors refuse to talk like people, and health officials refuse to talk like people through this epidemic. And so they couch everything with all the qualifiers, and also they don't speak in, you know, rather than adapting their language to the vernacular of regular human beings, they expect us to talk like them and understand the way they talk. And I think that's created much unnecessary confusion. You know, I don't know how many times I hear people say, well, doctors don't really know how AIDS is spread. Well, the fact is that from 1982, doctors have known everything about how this disease is spread. Absolutely nothing has changed. It's the most easy aspect of this disease to understand. There are things that are mysterious about AIDS. How the virus works once it's inside the body, that's mysterious. How we can stop this virus, that's mysterious. But one thing that's not mysterious is how this virus gets into bodies.
Well, do you feel certain that scientists know for sure that it is absolutely not spread through saliva?
Yeah. I mean, clearly, it would have happened by now. You know, it's the, and you know, people worry a lot about their gay waiters, and it's so funny. In San Francisco, we have a joke that, you know, how many heterosexual waiters does it take to screw in a light bulb? And the answer is both of them, because there aren't any heterosexual waiters in San Francisco. And unless you went to a restaurant and ordered up an order of anal intercourse or something, you're not going to get AIDS from your gay waiter. It would have happened. The whole town would have been dead by now. And there's just a lot of, I mean, Americans are good at one thing beyond all else, and that's common sense. And I think if we use more common sense with this and realize if there are mysterious ways of this thing spreading, if mosquitoes could do it, if you could get it from being next to somebody, it would have happened by now. It's not just, you know, waiting to debut in the, you know, next TV season or something.
You've criticized the federal government and state and city governments for their lack of action and their lack of attention to AIDS. There's a presidential campaign on the horizon. Do you think that AIDS will become a campaign issue?
You know, the political experts I've talked to say that their poll shows that AIDS is the most talked about domestic concern after the economy that voters bring up. And clearly AIDS is going to be a major issue in next year's presidential race. And what you're seeing already in the Republican side, you're seeing candidates starting to define themselves. On one hand, you've got Robertson, who's saying that he's favoring quarantine of all people with AIDS. Senator Robert Dole, who is trying to forge a position as a moderate on social issues while a physical on economic issues, is taking the public health point of view on this and saying, you know, we should let our doctors fight this disease. And he's taking a much more moderate stance on AIDS. George Bush will be left defending the Reagan administration, which I wouldn't want to be left doing. And then on the Democrats are still fumbling. I think they'll probably want to come with a traditional Democratic theme of compassion. Let's stick together and whip this thing. And I think that's probably what we'll see emerge with this. But it's clearly going to be a major issue. And questions like testing, and quarantine, I think, are going to be bandied about much more heavily in the next year.
You live in San Francisco, write for the San Francisco Chronicle, and for years you have been following and writing about the gay movement. Do you think that the AIDS epidemic is changing the political nature of the gay movement?
It's redefined the gay movement. I think in a lot of ways that have been very positive. And I don't know if the gay movement is the right way to say it. I'd say gay community. For years, we used the term gay community, and it was something that in truth had existence only in election years when politicians were campaigning for votes. There are gay neighborhoods where gay people live together, but there wasn't really a sense of community. Now, in cities across the country, the gay community is truly becoming a community. It's in sort of the throes of this horrible tragedy. Organizations, you know, virtually every gay person I know is involved in some kind of volunteer group where they help other people out. They're involved in some kind of community service. And in taking care of each other and in forming those kinds of basic institutions that help other people out, the gay community is truly becoming a community. And that's been, I think, the most profound development that we've seen from the AIDS epidemic in urban gay neighborhoods.
We only have a few seconds left, but I know you know a lot of people who have died of AIDS, and you have many friends who have died of AIDS. Has it helped you personally through these tragedies to know that, well, you can't stop the epidemic, but you're covering it, you're writing about it, you're investigating things that are happening behind the scenes?
Yeah, I mean, you try to do what you can do, and you try to make some contribution, because it's a, you know, suffering is very character building. I could do with a little less character right now and a lot more of my friends.
Yeah. Randy Schultz, thanks very much for talking with us. My guest has been investigative journalist Randy Schultz. Has just written a new book, And the Band Played On, Politics, People, and the AIDS Epidemic, and it's published by the St. Martin's Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Joan Didion. She's a novelist, journalist, and screenwriter. Her new book is about Miami, so I hope you can join us. Thank you. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, suspense writer Patricia Highsmith talks about her new novel, Found in the Street. In the more than 30 years since Alfred Hitchcock made her first book, Strangers on a Train, into a movie, Highsmith has become a best-selling author in Europe with a growing American following. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward samples some Beatle tunes that the Beatles never recorded. And book critic John Leonard reviews Michael Schmidt's novel, The Dresden Gate, about the conflicts between European and Latin American culture in Mexico on the eve of the revolution. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Ann Bozell in Washington. A Soviet foreign ministry spokesman says Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev will come to the U.S. to sign an agreement eliminating medium-range nuclear missiles in the near future. The announcement appears to be a reversal of Gorbachev's refusal last week to set a summit date. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Foreign Ministry spokesman Boris Pyatyshev told a press conference today that the nearly completed agreement banning medium-range missiles would be signed by Gorbachev and President Reagan in the near future. That was a surprise change from last week, when Gorbachev told Secretary of State George Shultz that he was not ready to go to the U.S. until progress was made on other arms negotiations, including limits on President Reagan's Star Wars program. The foreign ministry spokesman insisted that Gorbachev wasn't backing off from his demand that the Reagan administration limit Star Wars, but Gorbachev now appears to be saying that concessions on Star Wars are not a condition for the long-awaited summit in Washington. This is Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Stock prices closed higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 52 points to 1846.49. Advance's Edge declines by a small margin on a volume of 255 million shares. Improvements on the Hong Kong and Tokyo exchanges and a $1 billion stock buyback plan by IBM helped the Dow recover about a third of yesterday's big loss. The newly formed panel of congressional leaders and Reagan administration officials began their first deficit reduction meeting today. President Reagan says the drop in the stock market shows, quote, the potential dangers on the economic horizon. He and top lawmakers have pledged to put politics aside during negotiations on ways to trim $23 billion from the federal budget deficit. The president and his wife Nancy flew to Phoenix today to make funeral arrangement for Nancy's mother, Edith Davis. Mrs. Davis died of a stroke yesterday at the age of 91. President Reagan's chief of staff and key Democrats in Congress discussed potential Supreme Court candidates today. UPI's Barbara Campbell reports.
White House Chief of Staff Howard Baker has finished presenting a list of possible Supreme Court nominees to Senate Democratic leader Robert Byrd and Judiciary Committee Chairman Joseph Biden. Baker says President Reagan will not make his decision until he hears Baker's report on his consultations with the Democrats and with Republican leaders. Baker would not speculate on when the president would announce his choice.
I think we should move as fast as we can. There's nothing magic about Thursday. There's nothing magic about this week. But I think, as Senator Byrd pointed out, the calendar will overwhelm us before long.
The Senate, which rejected the president's appointment of Robert Bork, is due to recess for the year November 21st. But many think there will be enough work to keep the Senate in session until Christmas. Barbara Campbell, Capitol Hill.
Chrysler Corporation Chairman Lee Iacocca confirmed today that the number three U.S. automaker will lay off 10% of its white-collar workforce by the end of the year. He said more cutbacks will follow because of the addition of 5,700 salaried employees when Chrysler acquired American Motors.
Maybe more, maybe less. We inherited 5,700 AMC white salaried people. We had hoped, we're just sorting that out, we had hoped we could keep a good number of them, but we've accelerated our plan. The plan was to have this all worked out by June 30th, but the events of the last month indicate that we better get moving quick.
Iacocca also said one of the company's assembly plants will close next year because of the AMC merger. Voters in South Korea have overwhelmingly approved a new constitution which calls for sweeping democratic reforms. Approval of the document clears the way for the first direct presidential election in 16 years. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For over two decades, musicians around the world have recorded their own versions of Beatles songs. But you may not know that John Lennon and Paul McCartney also wrote songs that were recorded by other groups before the Beatles ever did them, if they did them at all. Today, our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, digs up some of these old recordings, including a McCartney instrumental called Catcall, recorded in the mid-60s by the Chris Barber Orchestra.
Beatles changed more than the sound of contemporary pop music. They also changed the way the business of music worked. For the first time, record companies were faced with performers who wrote nearly all their own material, something you would never have caught Frank Sinatra doing, and what that meant was that the songs they wrote, they kept. But it took a while for that revolution to happen, and in the early days, when the Lennon and McCartney writing team was young and prolific, their manager, Brian Epstein, saw them as the key writers who would provide plenty of material to all of the acts he managed. The lads were agreeable, extra income, you know, so Epstein slipped Do You Want to Know a Secret to Billy J. Kramer in the Dakotas. On the other side was a song credited to McCartney Lennon called I'll Be On My Way.
The sun is fading away, that's the end of the day. As the tune light turns to moonlight, I'll be on my way. Just one kiss and I'll go. Don't hide the tears that don't show. As the June light turns to moonlight, I'll be on my way.
It certainly shows Paul's debt to Buddy Holly, but the next song they sent to Kramer, Bad to Me, sounds like pure, if second-rate, Beatles.
If you ever leave me, I'll be sad and blue. Don't you ever leave me, I'm so in love with you.
The birds in the sky would be sad and lonely if they knew that I lost my one and only. They'd be sad if you're bad to me. The leaves on the trees would be softly sighing if they heard from the breeze that you left me crying. They'd be sad. Don't be bad to me.
After that were songs for Tommy Quickley, The Foremost, a Merseybeat band that never made it, and Cilla Black. Again, most of these were pretty poor, but check out The Foremost's recording, I'm in Love.
I got something to tell you, I'm in love. I've been longing to tell you, I'm in love. You believe me when I tell you, I'm in love with you. You're my kind of girl.
A little polite, but not bad. But Paul and John didn't really start having hits outside Epstein's stable until they handed a young London band, the Rolling Stones, a song called I Want to Be Your Man, and then launched Peter and Gordon's career with this song.
Please lock me away and don't allow the day here inside where I hide with my loneliness.
I don't care what they say, I won't stay in a world without love. Birds sing out of tune.
World Without Love went to the top of the charts in England and America, and Paul, at least, was quite happy. After all, Peter Asher was his girlfriend's brother. By 1965, whether because the songs weren't flowing like they had or because the extra income only meant tax problems, the giveaways almost stopped. There was an awful song for P.J. Proby called That Means a Lot in 1965, and in 1968, Cilla Black recorded a bossa nova rock number called Step Inside, Love.
Step inside, love. Let me find you a place where the cares of the day will be carried away by the smile on your face. We are together now and forever.
The only other hit didn't even have their names on it. Woman, recorded by Peter and Gordon, was credited to Bernard Webb to prove that it wasn't the Beatle name selling their records.
Woman, do you love me? Woman, if you need to love me, believe me, I need you to be my woman.
Maybe yes, maybe no. It didn't do as well as World Without Love, but by this time the Beatles had inspired other performers, and everybody was writing their own material as if that's the way it had always been. How quickly we forget.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
You're listening to Fresh Air.
My guest is writer Patricia Highsmith, whose psychological thrillers have brought her a wide following in Europe and a cult following in America. Highsmith was born in Texas in 1921, but moved to Europe in 1963. She's written 19 novels and 6 collections of short stories. Like most of her previous books, her new novel, Found in the Street, begins with a coincidence that has lasting repercussions. In this case, a paranoid loner in Greenwich Village finds the wallet of a young married illustrator. He returns the wallet and won't stay out of the artist's life. Patricia Highsmith is best known for her first novel, Strangers on a Train, which Alfred Hitchcock made into a movie in 1951. I spoke to Highsmith when she visited New York this week, and she told me how Hitchcock first learned of her book.
I was then living in New York, and my agent was in New York, and it's customary to send a couple of copies of books to Hollywood so that potential filmmakers have a chance to take a look at it. And I think Hitchcock is, I know he was very fond of trains, and so he took a fancy to this one, and it was bought quickly by him.
Did he tell you what themes most interested him in your novel?
No, not at all, because, in fact, I never met him, and he was working then in California. But he did ring me up once during his work, and he said he'd had the second murder, which, of course, he finally did. It frequently happens in my books that what I can do in the way of words to show the internal workings of a person's mind cannot be done in film, and that's what happened in this case.
In John Russell Taylor's biography of Alfred Hitchcock, Taylor wrote that Hitchcock paid $2,000 for the screen rights to your novel.
That's not true.
And he also said, and you can tell me if this is true, Taylor also wrote that Hitchcock said to you, you should actually pay me for making it because it's really going to have a great effect on your career. Is that true?
No. Actually, he paid me $7,500, of which my agent took 10%. And I never had such a personal conversation with Mr. Hitchcock, as to say it would help my career. But in fact, it did. It did help my career, and at once. And at that point, I was, I think I was 28 when the thing was sold, or 29 or something. It did definitely help my career, there's no doubt.
In your latest book, Found in the Street, there's a theme that was also present in your first novel, Strangers on a Train. And I'm thinking of the fact that there are two male characters in each of those books, who are, in a way, doubles of each other. But one is a less successful, slightly deranged twin of the other. What interests you in that idea of the psychological double?
Well, in the case of Strangers on a Train, it's more clear to me that those two men were much bound up by the fact that there was a murder or potential murder. I don't know. I don't consider them twins, but there is maybe a possibility of crime in some people. I don't really believe that everybody can murder. But and then in my present book, Found in the Street, it's not so much that they're opposite, these men, but that they focus on the one pretty girl, the girl age 20, who is very eye-catching. And if the book has a theme, it is that the people in love always attribute virtues and charm and talent even to the person they're in love with. Perhaps the person is quite empty and hasn't got these things at all. So this girl in my book is so young that they can imagine that she may have these talents and the potentiality. Both of the men believe this about the girl. That's what binds them together in the book.
The Atlantic Monthly Press is bringing out new editions of several of your books. Do you think that your books are being seen in a different light now or reevaluated?
No, I'm not sure about that at all. I do know that I had difficulty in America with publishers because from time to time I write quite a few short stories, and my fifth book of short stories is coming out very soon in England. But the American publishers think that short stories do not make any money, and consequently, they reject me. Then I have to look for another publisher who either does the short story book or I have to forget it and write a novel to please them. So the result is that I've had something like five American publishers, which I don't like because it sounds as if I'm disloyal.
I read somewhere that before you started writing novels that you wrote comic books to make a living.
Yes.
What kind?
With running characters, one of them was called the Black Terror. So my job was to sit there. It's something like turning out two grade B films per day. You simply think of a plot concerning the certain characters, and then you type it at great speed. It was terribly easy to write.
How did you get the job?
I answered an ad in the newspaper. I was 22, I think. And, of course, I had to earn my living. I had a small apartment. So the advertisement was Reporter Rewrite, and I thought it was probably a newspaper of some kind. So I walked into a comic office, So I said, well, I'm just out of college and blah, blah, blah. And so I had the job in about 20 minutes. And then, of course, I had to learn it. One has to learn it as if it were a craft. It's like putting heels on shoes. So you have to, working in leather, I mean, you have to learn it. That takes a couple of days because it has very little to do with writing or with poetry or anything personal. It was not at all personal to me. You just manufacture stories for these comic books.
I could see how that kind of work, even if it's like putting heels on shoes, could actually be really liberating for a writer because since it's not poetry, you don't have to sit there worrying about every word and you just force yourself to just churn it out, which might actually free you up, get you to know that you can just sit down and write when you have to.
That's true, yes. I was lucky, I think, in getting that.
I think a lot of women writers started out writing for magazines like True Confessions or for women's magazines. Did you ever go any of those routes? Because I think those publications are probably more open to women than the comics or the pulps were.
Well, yes, but I associate them with love affairs. And first of all, I'm terribly shy about writing about love affairs, and I can't take it all that seriously. And then the prudishness, when I was in my early 20s, that it was just too much. I think I had two sales of short stories to the Sleeks, which paid about $800 and a fortune in those days. But you've got to clean it up. I mean, they've got to be married before they possibly jump into bed together. I mean, all this is just, it's so phony. I mean, it didn't interest me to do that. It's better to work with the comics than to do that, I think.
You've written that although it's very important to spend a lot of time writing, it's perhaps equally important to spend some time not writing and to spend some time where you're just letting your mind roam and daydream.
That's very true, yes. That's my recipe for success. But I can mainly do it at home. There's always something in my house, or I take a walk, or I do something in a garden, if I have one, a small garden.
Is that the key to daydreaming, to be involved with your body and doing something but have your mind be free to roam?
Yes, that's my idea of daydreaming.
And do your novels usually come to you in one of those daydreams, the story?
Yes, very definitely. Novel idea or a short story idea or something funny. They come when I'm not trying to think hard about getting an idea.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Patricia Highsmith's new novel, Found in the Street, is published by the Atlantic Monthly Press. This spring, Atlantic Monthly Press will reissue her novels A Game for the Living and The Two Faces of January. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up?
Tonight we have a profile on William Randolph Hearst, the newspaper man who's probably best remembered for his contribution to yellow journalism. And a lot of people also know him as Citizen Kane in Orson Welles' film. But there's much more to the man and his work, and tonight you'll hear about it. Also, Linda Wertheimer takes us along as she accompanies Democratic presidential hopeful Richard Gebhardt on the stump. And Terry, you've heard of straw polls. Well, tonight we have a report on an ice cream poll.
What do you get to vote for?
Oh, some of the choices include Dukakis, Massa Chewy Chocolate, Dole's Top Banana, and Bush's Preppy Mint.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our book critic John Leonard has a review of Michael Schmidt's new novel, The Dresden Gate. Like Schmidt's first novel, Green Island, published in 1982, The Dresden Gate is set in Mexico and is about a clash between colonial and indigenous cultures.
Ordinarily, if you want to read fiction about Latin America, stick with the Latin Americans. They know how to tease their own ghosts. Whereas even the best of the European novelists, when they go south of the border, do so because they're tired of themselves and want the energy of the exotic. And they bring their symbolic binoculars and their heart of darkness with them. They look at the jungle and the volcanoes, and what they see are the ruins of European systems, capitalism, colonialism, imperialism, Marxism, Christianity, and they despair all over again on someone else's time, which is a kind of imperialism of the imagination. Michael Schmidt is a different, special case. Born and raised in Mexico, but of European stock, educated in the United States and England, a poet, a publisher, and editor of a British literary magazine, he is a refugee from everywhere, although both his novels have been set in Mexico. In the Dresden Gate, Mexico, sometime after the misrule of the Habsburg Maximilian, on the eve of a violent 20th century revolution, is real, and the European characters are merely symbolic. Their time is over, and they should go home, but they don't have one. This textured Mexico is just getting to know itself. Its Indians are barefoot, and its priests wear masks, and on the Day of the Dead, children burn votive candles and eat skulls sculpted out of sugar, but they are beginning to dream their own future, to invent themselves without the white man's help. Whereas the white men in this novel are states of mind, dispossessed, cut off from their own history in a plantation fortress behind a wrought iron gate. Meet the paterfamilias Don Raul. He thought to change the bad luck of his life in France by buying this Mexican estate from the last of the German Obermüllers, who'd had enough feeding at the New World trough. The gold is gone, and there's not enough water to irrigate the sugar cane, and the natives are menacing. But Don Raul doesn't notice, because he can only look inward at an emptiness of purpose. His bored and pretty wife Paula has left him. His younger bohemian brother Alex is dead. And his son and only child, blonde, blue-eyed, nameless, seems to waste away from lack of belonging and lack of meaning. The huge hinged gate brought all the way from Germany, a symbol of every pretension of European culture, isn't proof against peons who have found their voice in blood. The nameless boy may want to lose himself in this fresh blood, to choose Mexico over his father, but Mexico is a different color, naming itself, and under no obligation to accept him. There's nothing here of what the critic Irving Howe calls Latin American boom boom. Modest and concise, yet shadowy and elusive and haunting, the Dresden Gate is almost lugubrious in its ambiguities, like Kafka's castle in the wrong America. Maybe, suggests Schmidt, the weariness of the North is sexual as well as cultural, panned out, bone dry, and bleached. Maybe the brown-skinned peons are for the nameless boy a kind of repressed unconscious, historical or otherwise. Maybe he thinks the black Madonna is the mother who renounced him. The point is, whatever the white man thinks and wants no longer matters. Mexico, dreaming its own dream, doesn't care.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Canadian writer and naturalist Farley Mowat. He spent his life living with and writing about the Eskimos and wildlife of the North. His new book is about a kindred spirit, Diane Fossey, who devoted her life to studying the mountain gorilla in Africa and trying to save them from extinction. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a new CD of the late pianist Glenn Gould performing the Goldberg Variations, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will discuss Esperanto, the international language created 100 years ago that still hasn't quite caught on. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National.